Hello, my name's Dave Emery. This is side two of For the Record program number 563, titled A Tale of Two Heroes. This has been recorded on August 6th of the year 2006. The two heroes in question are the late John O'Neill, the FBI operative in charge of the Al-Qaeda investigation, who, after resigning from the FBI because he had concluded that there were powerful corporate interests in the United States that were deliberately obscuring his investigation into Al-Qaeda because of the links running in the direction of Saudi Arabia, he then became director of security for the World Trade Center and died in the September 11th attacks. I would encourage people who have the technology to do so to go to the www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery website and listen to side A of For the Record program number 310, recorded in early July of 2001. Recorded in early July of 2001, that program aired on WFMU on Monday night, September 10th of 2001. The For the Record shows used to be aired on Monday nights, and that WFMU was right across the river from where the World Trade Center at that time was and from where it used to be at this point. And then side A of that program in many ways foreshadows the September 11th attacks. And about so a little over 12 hours later, John O'Neill died in those attacks. That broadcast is something of a memorial for the late John O'Neill, one of the heroes described here. And for the cynics slash skeptics concerning yours truly's work, well, check that out. It is, I think, a haunting broadcast, and that's said in all modesty. In any event, returning to the article that we're reading is from the New Yorker magazine's issue of July 10th through 17th of 2006. The article is titled The Agent, subtitled Did the CIA Stop an FBI Detective from Preventing 9/11? It's authored by Lawrence Wright, and we're going to resume. By the way, in addition to John O'Neill, the other hero here is Ali Soufan, a Lebanese-American whom, as I said in side one, embodies the very best of the American and Arabic character, and an individual who, well, it's sort of appropriate with the horrifying events unfolding now in Lebanon. This is perhaps apropos. By the way, I will be discussing the situation there next week. As listeners might guess, it is far more complex than we have been led to believe. And as veteran For the Record listeners might guess, it's even worse than what we have been led to believe. Very bad indeed, but such is life. Returning once again to The Agent, did the CIA stop an FBI detective from preventing 9/11 by Lawrence Wright? It reads, continuing, picking up from where we left off in side one, as follows. Indeed, actually, let's overlap this slightly with what we did on side one. Quote, the CIA people couldn't stand the fact that Ali's opinion and analysis were correct, an FBI counterterrorism official who worked with Soufan told me. He was an Arabic speaker and an FBI agent on the ground who was running circles around them. Nevertheless, the CIA recognized Soufan's abilities and repeatedly tried to recruit him. Come over to the dark side, an agency operative once said to him. You know you're interested. Soufan said that he just laughed. Indeed, some of the CIA's best information about Al-Qaeda came from the FBI. In 1998, FBI investigators found an essential clue, a phone number in Yemen that functioned as a virtual switchboard for the terror network. The bombers in East Africa called that number before and after the attacks, so did Osama bin Laden. The number belonged to a jihadi named Ahmed al-Hada. By combing through the records of all the calls made to and from that number, FBI investigators constructed a map of Al-Qaeda's global organization. The phone line was monitored as soon as it was discovered, but the CIA, as the primary organization for gathering foreign intelligence, had jurisdiction over conversations on the Hada phone and did not provide the FBI with the information it was getting about Al-Qaeda's plans. A conversation on the Hada phone at the end of 1999 mentioned a forthcoming meeting of Al-Qaeda operatives in Malaysia. The CIA learned the name of one participant, Khaled al-Midar, and the first name of another, Nawaf. Both men were Saudi citizens. The CIA did not pass this intelligence to the FBI. However, the CIA did share the information with Saudi authorities, who told the agency that Midar and a man named Nawaf al-Hazmi were members of al-Qaeda. Based on this intelligence, the CIA broke into a hotel room in Dubai where Midar was staying en route to Malaysia. The operatives photocopied Midar's passport and faxed it to Alex Station, the CIA unit devoted to tracking bin Laden. Inside the passport was the critical information that Midar had a U.S. visa. The agency did not alert the FBI or the State Department so that Midar's name could be put on a terror watch list, which would have prevented him from entering the U.S. The CIA asked Malaysian authorities to provide surveillance of the meeting in Kuala Lumpur, which took place on January 5, 2000, at a condominium overlooking a golf course designed by Jack Nicklaus. The condo was owned by a Malaysian businessman who had ties to al-Qaeda. The payphone that Soufan had queried the agency about was directly in front of the condo. Khalid used it to place calls to Kuso in Yemen. Although the CIA later denied that it knew anything about the phone, the number was recorded in the Malaysian surveillance log, which was given to the agency. At the time of the Kuala Lumpur meeting, Special Branch, the Malaysian Secret Service, photographed about a dozen al-Qaeda associates outside the condo and visiting nearby internet cafes. These pictures were turned over to the CIA. The meeting was not wiretapped. Had it been, the agency might have uncovered the plots that culminated in the bombing of the Kohl and the September 11, 2001 attacks. On January 8th, Special Branch notified the CIA that three of the men who had been at the meeting, Midar, Hazmi, and Khalid, were traveling together to Bangkok. There, Khalid met with Kuso and one of the suicide bombers of the Kohl. Kuso gave Khalid the $36,000, which was most likely used to buy tickets to Los Angeles for Midar and Hazmi and provide them with living expenses in the U.S. Both men ended up on planes involved in the September 11th attacks. In March, the CIA learned that Hazmi had flown to Los Angeles 2 months earlier on January 15th. Had the agency checked the flight manifest, it would have noticed that Midar was traveling with him. Once again, the agency neglected to inform the FBI or the State Department that at least one al-Qaeda operative was in the country. Although the CIA was legally bound to share this kind of information with the Bureau, it was protective of sensitive intelligence. The agency sometimes feared that FBI prosecutions resulting from such intelligence might compromise its relationship with foreign services, although there were safeguards to protect confidential information. The CIA was particularly wary of O'Neill, who demanded control of any case that touched on an FBI investigation. Many CIA officials disliked him and feared that he could not be trusted with sensitive intelligence. O'Neill was duplicitous, Michael Scheuer, the official who founded Alex Station but has now left the CIA, told me. He had no concerns outside of making the Bureau look good, unquote. Several of O'Neill's subordinates suggested that the CIA hid information out of personal animosity. They hated John, the FBI counterterrorism official assigned to Alex Station told me. They knew that John would have marched in there and taken control of that case, unquote. The CIA may also have been protecting an overseas operation and was afraid that the FBI would expose it. Moreover, Midar and Hazmi could have seemed like attractive recruitment possibilities. The CIA was desperate for a source inside al-Qaeda, having failed to penetrate the inner circle or even to place someone in the training camps, even though they were largely open to anyone who showed up. However, once Midar and Hazmi entered the United States, they were the province of the FBI. The CIA had no legal authority to operate inside the country. In the end, the CIA's failure to inform the FBI may be best explained by the fact that the agency was drowning in a flood of threats and warnings and simply did not see the pivotal importance of this intelligence. Whatever the reason for the CIA's lapse, many FBI investigators remain furious that they were not informed of the presence of al-Qaeda operatives inside America. Midar and Hazmi arrived 20 months before September 11th. Kenneth Maxwell, Soufan's former supervisor, told me, "Two al-Qaeda guys living in California, are you kidding me? We would have been on them like white on snow. Physical surveillance, electronic surveillance, a special unit devoted entirely to them," unquote. Of course, the FBI had other opportunities to prevent September 11th. In July 2001, an FBI agent in Phoenix suggested interviewing Arabs enrolled in American flight schools. A month later, the Bureau's Minnesota office requested permission to aggressively investigate Zaharias Moussaoui, who later confessed to being an al-Qaeda associate. Both proposals were rejected by FBI supervisors, but Midar and Hazmi were directly involved in the September 11th conspiracy. Because of their connection to bin Laden, who had a federal indictment against him, the FBI had all the authority it needed to use every investigative technique to penetrate and disrupt the al-Qaeda cell. Instead, the hijackers were free to develop their plot until it was too late to stop them. In Yemen, the security situation deteriorated rapidly. Soufan and the other FBI agents were quartered at the Aden Hotel, crammed in with other U.S. military and government employees, including Marine guards, and billeted 3 and 4 to a room. Several dozen slept on bedrolls in the hotel ballroom. Gunfire erupted outside the hotel so frequently the agents slept in their clothes with their weapons at their sides. Agents learned from a mechanic in Aden that after the bombing, some men brought to his shop a truck similar to the one used by the bombers. The men wanted to have metal plates installed in such a way that they could direct the force of an explosion. Certainly, the most tempting target for such a bomb would be the Aden Hotel. It wasn't clear that the Yemeni government troops who were guarding the hotel with machine gun nests would truly protect the Americans. "We were prisoners," an agent recalled. One night, shots were fired on the street while O'Neill was running a meeting inside the hotel. The Marines and the hostage rescue team adopted defensive positions. Soufan ventured out unarmed to talk to the Yemeni troops. "Hey, Ali," O'Neill called out, "be careful." He raced down the steps of the hotel to make sure Soufan was wearing his flak jacket. Frustration, stress, and danger, along with the enforced intimacy of their situation, had brought the two men even closer. O'Neill had begun to describe Soufan as his secret weapon, unquote. Speaking to the Yemenis, he called him simply, "my son," unquote. Snipers covered Soufan as he approached a Yemeni officer who assured him that everything was okay. "If everything is okay, why are there no cars on the street?" Soufan asked. The officer said that there must be a wedding nearby. Soufan looked around and saw that the hotel was surrounded by a large number of men in traditional dress, some in jeeps, all carrying guns. They were civilians, not soldiers. They could be intelligence officers or a tribal group bent on revenge. In either case, they easily outnumbered the Americans. Soufan was reminded of the 1993 uprising in Somalia, which ended with 18 American soldiers dead and one of the bodies being dragged to the streets of Mogadishu. The hotel backed up to the harbor and the Americans were essentially trapped. After Soufan went inside and offered his assessment of the situation, O'Neill ordered the Marines to deploy 2 armored vehicles to block the street in front of the hotel. The night passed without further incident, but the next day, O'Neill moved the investigators to the USS Duluth, stationed 10 miles away in the Bay of Aden. That proved to be a dangerous mistake. The next morning, when O'Neill and Soufan were flying back to town, their helicopter suddenly lurched into violent evasive maneuvers. The pilot reported that an SA-7 missile had locked in on them. O'Neill decided to send most of the investigators home. Those who remained returned to the deserted hotel. Just before Thanksgiving, the FBI pulled O'Neill out of Yemen, apparently as a concession to Ambassador Bodine, who felt that the FBI presence was straining diplomatic relations between America and Yemen. Soufan stayed on, but the threats in Aden became so acute that he and the other agents moved to the American embassy in Sana'a, Yemen's capital. The investigation was losing its momentum. In the spring of 2001, Tom Wilshire, a CIA liaison at FBI headquarters in Washington, was studying the relationship between Khaled al-Midar, the Saudi al-Qaeda operative, and Khalad, the one-legged jihadi. Because of the similarity of the names, the CIA had thought that they might be the same person, but thanks in part to Ali Soufan's investigations in Yemen, the agency now knew that they were not, and that Khalad had orchestrated the Cole attack. "Okay, this is important," Wilshire said of Khalad in an email to his supervisors at the CIA Counterterrorist Center. "This is a major league killer." Wilshire already knew that Hazmi, the other Saudi operative, had arrived in the United States and that Midar was possibly with him. "Something bad is definitely up," Wilshire wrote to a colleague. He asked permission to disclose this vital information to the FBI. His superiors at the CIA never responded to his request to disclose it to the Bureau. In an official statement, the CIA questioned the accuracy of this article, but did not address specific allegations. It said, "Based on rigorous internal and external reviews of its shortcomings and successes before and after 9/11, the CIA has improved its processing and sharing of intelligence. CIA's focus is on learning and even closer cooperations with partners inside and outside government, not on public finger-pointing, which does not serve the American people well," unquote. That summer, Wilshire asked an FBI analyst to review the material on the Malaysia meeting, but he did not reveal that some of the participants might be in the United States. More important, he conveyed none of the urgency reflected in his email. He told the analyst that she should examine the material in her free time. She didn't get around to it until the end of July. Wilshire did want to know, however, what the FBI knew. He asked Dina Corsi, another FBI analyst, to show three surveillance photos from the Malaysia meeting to several I-49 agents. The pictures showed Midar and Hazmi and a man who the CIA believed resembled Kuso, the Cole cameraman. Wilshire told Corsi that one of the men was named Khaled al-Midar, but he did not explain why the pictures had been taken, and he did not mention that Midar had a U.S. visa. According to the 9/11 Commission report, on June 11th, the CIA supervisor went with the FBI analyst and Corsi to New York to meet with FBI case agents on the Cole investigation. Soufan, who was still in Yemen, did not attend. The meeting started in mid-morning with the CIA New York agents briefing the CIA supervisor, Clark Shannon, for 3 or 4 hours on the progress of their investigation. Corsi then showed the three Malaysia photographs to her FBI colleagues. They were high-quality surveillance photos. One, shot from a low angle, showed Midar and Hazmi standing beside a tree in Malaysia. Shannon wanted to know if the agents recognized anyone. The I-49 agents asked who was in the pictures and when and where they had been taken. "Were there any other photographs of this meeting?" one of the FBI agents demanded. Shannon refused to say. Corsi promised that in the days and weeks to come, she would try to get permission to pass that information along. The meeting became heated. The FBI agents suggested that these photographs pertained directly to crimes they were trying to solve, but they couldn't elicit any further information from Shannon. Corsi finally dropped the name Khaled al-Midar. Steve Bonghart, Soufan's top assistant in the Cole investigation, asked Shannon to provide a date of birth or a passport number to go with Midar's name. A name by itself was not sufficient to prevent his entry into the United States. Bonghart had just returned from Pakistan with a list of 30 names of suspected al-Qaeda operatives and their dates of birth, which he had given to the State Department. That was standard procedure, the first thing most investigators would do. But Shannon declined to provide the additional information. Top CIA officials had not authorized him to disclose the vital details of Midar's U.S. visa, his association with Hazmi, and their affiliation with Khalad and al-Qaeda. There was a fourth photograph of the Malaysia meeting that Shannon did not produce. That was a picture of Khalad, the one-legged operative. Thanks to Soufan's interrogation of Kuso, the Cole investigators had an active file on Khalad and were preparing to indict him. Knowledge of that fourth photo would likely have prompted O'Neill to demand the CIA turn over all information relating to Khalid and his associates. By withholding the picture of Khalid attending the meeting with the future hijackers, the CIA may, in effect, have allowed the September 11th plot to proceed. That summer, Midar returned to Yemen and then went to Saudi Arabia, where presumably he helped the remaining hijackers secure entry into the United States. 2 days after the frustrating June 11th meeting, Midar received another American visa from the consulate in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. Since the CIA had not given his name to the State Department to post on its watch list, Midar arrived in New York on the 4th of July. The June 11th meeting was the culmination of a strange trend in the U.S. government toward hiding information from the people who most needed it. In this regard, the FBI was as guilty as the CIA. A federal law at the time prohibiting the sharing of information arising from grand jury testimony, but the FBI took it as a nearly absolute bar to revealing any investigative evidence and, as a result, repeatedly turned down requests for information from other intelligence agencies. The Joint Congressional Inquiry on 9/11 claimed that the law, quote, came to be used simply as an excuse for not sharing information, unquote. In 1995, the Justice Department established a policy known as the Wall, which regulated the exchange of foreign intelligence information between agents and criminal investigators. Managers at FBI headquarters misinterpreted the policy, turning it into a straitjacket for their own investigators. Intelligence agents were warned that sharing such information with criminal agents could be the end of their careers. The Wall, the FBI decided, separated even people who were on the same squad. The FBI also began withholding intelligence from the White House. Every morning on the classified computers of the National Security Council, there were at least 100 reports from the CIA, the NSA, and other intelligence branches, but FBI never disseminated information. The CIA embraced the idea of the Wall with equal vigor. The agency frequently decided not to share intelligence with the FBI on the ground that it would compromise, quote, sensitive sources and methods, unquote. For example, the CIA collected other crucial information about Midar that it did not provide to the FBI. Midar, it turned out, was the son-in-law of Ahmed al-Hada, the al-Qaeda loyalist in Yemen whose phone number operated as the network's switchboard. After arriving in New York on July 4th, Midar flew to San Diego and rented an apartment. From there, he made 8 calls to the Hada phone to talk to his wife, who was about to give birth. In the I-49 squad's office, there was a link chart showing the connections between Hada's phone and other phones around the world. Had a line been drawn from Hada's Yemen home to Midar's San Diego apartment, al-Qaeda's presence in America would have been glaringly obvious. After September 11th, the CIA claimed that it had divulged Midar's identity to the FBI in a timely manner. Indeed, both George Tenet, the agency's director, and Cofer Black, the head of its counterterrorism division, testified to Congress that this was the case. Later, the 9/11 Commission concluded that the statements of both were false. The CIA was unable to provide evidence proving that the information had been passed to the Bureau. Due to the limitations of time, I'm going to skip well down in this article. Suffice it to say that in the description for this broadcast, the article will be reproduced in its entirety. After Ali Soufan learned that, in fact, the CIA had deliberately avoided disclosing information that might have prevented the September 11th attacks, we read, Soufan's delusionment with the government was so profound that he eventually quit the Bureau. In 2005, he became Director of International Operations for Giuliani Security and Safety, a company founded by Rudolph W. Giuliani, the former mayor of New York. And skipping down still further, Ali Soufan's skill and his understanding of Arab culture permitted him to break an al-Qaeda operative named Abu Jandal. Skipping down and reading, as it happened, Abu Jandal was also in Yemeni custody, and the Americans arranged to interview him. He was a large, powerful man with a dark beard. "What are these infidels doing here?" he demanded. He took a plastic chair and turned it around, sitting with his arms crossed and his back to the interrogators. After some coaxing, Soufan got Abu Jandal to face him, but he refused to look him in the eye. Abu Jandal did want to talk. However, he delivered a lengthy, rapid-fire rant against America. And I'm going to skip down still further. I'm going to, again, in the written description for this broadcast, this article will be reproduced in its entirety so listeners can fill in the blanks. One of the things that's interesting about this, as Soufan, Ali Soufan, gradually began to break down Abu Jandal, talking about how true Muslims could not possibly sanction the bombing of the embassies in Africa and the killing of innocents or the attacks in New York, Abu Jandal was resistant and said, it must be the Jews. And that's something one hears in certain segments of the so-called 911 truth movement, the ultimate of oxymorons. It is interesting, however, how Soufan was able to break down Abu Jandal. Talking about the photographs of the attacks, Bin Laden did this, Soufan told him. Abu Jandal had heard about the attacks, but he didn't know many details. He studied the pictures in amazement. He said that they looked like a Hollywood production, unquote, but the scale of the atrocity visibly shook him. Skipping down still further. Coincidentally, a local Yemeni paper was on a shelf under the coffee table. Soufan showed it to Abu Jandal. The headline read, 200 Yemeni souls perish in New York attack, unquote. At the time, the death toll estimates were in the tens of thousands. Abu Jandal read the headline and drew a breath. God help us, he muttered. Soufan asked what kind of Muslim would do such a thing. Abu Jandal insisted that the Israelis must have committed the attacks on New York and Washington. The Sheikh is not that crazy, he said of Bin Laden. Soufan then took out a book of mugshots containing photographs of known al-Qaeda members and of the hijackers. He asked Abu Jandal to identify them. The Yemeni flipped through them quickly and closed the book. Soufan opened the book again and told him to take his time. Some of them I have in custody, he said, hoping that Abu Jandal wouldn't realize that the hijackers were all dead. Abu Jandal paused for a half second on the photograph of Shehi, the pilot of United Airlines Flight 175, before he started to turn the page. You're not done with this one, Soufan said. Ramadan, 1999. He's sick. You're his emir and you take care of him, unquote. Abu Jandal looked at Soufan in shock. When I ask you a question, I already know the answer, said Soufan. If you're smart, you'll tell me the truth. Abu Jandal conceded that he knew Shehi and gave his al-Qaeda nom de guerre, Abdullah al-Sharqi. He did the same with Khaled al-Midar and five others, including Mohammed Atta, the lead hijacker. But he still insisted that Bin Laden would never commit such an act. It was the Israelis, he maintained. I know for sure that the guys who did this were al-Qaeda guys, said Soufan. He took seven photographs out of the book and laid them on the table. How do you know? Abu Jandal asked. Who told you? You did, said Soufan. These are the hijackers. You just identified them. Abu Jandal turned pale. He covered his face with his hands. Give me a moment, he pleaded. Soufan walked out of the room. When he came back, he asked Abu Jandal what he thought now. I think the Sheikh, Bin Laden, went crazy, he said. And then he told Soufan everything he knew. This entire article will be in the description on the Spitfire website. We've been reading from an article from the New Yorker's issue of July 10th through 17th of 2006 called The Agent, Did the CIA Stop an FBI Detective from Preventing 9/11? It's by Lawrence Wright. The entire article will be in the written description for this broadcast. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 563, A Tale of Two Heroes, being recorded on August 6th of the year 2006. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.